Most of my training is as a geographer, and that shapes the perspective I bring to the study of the natural environment. If I were to describe geography for you, I would say that it is the discipline that focuses on the relationship between people and their environment. Part of that relationship is, of course, how people treat the environment, what people do to the environment. And that has been the focus of a lot of sessions so far this summer and will continue to be, given our summer theme. But part of the emphasis in geography is also how the environment affects people. And that's something that has not gotten quite as much attention this summer yet. And I think with this session, I'd like to at least get you thinking along those lines a little bit. And one thing that we need to realize is that there are certain aspects of the natural environment that are hazardous to people, hazardous to human life. It's not all nice and neat and safe. In geography, we refer to this particular study as the study of natural hazards, the study of natural processes that affect human activity. More likely, you'd be familiar with the term natural disasters to denote the kinds of events that I'm talking about. If you're in the insurance business, they're probably referred to as acts of God for some of these natural disasters. But what I'd like to do is give you a little bit of a framework for thinking about the hazardous aspects of our natural environment and how they affect our life, and in turn how the things we do contribute to that hazardousness. Now, let's start with just thinking about what some of these kinds of processes might be. We can kind of put them in two broad groups. One set of processes would be geological processes that take place within the Earth's crust and on the Earth's crust, and also meteorologic or atmospheric processes. Now, let me give you some examples of what we're talking about here. Some well-known geological hazards would be things like volcanoes and earthquakes. And maybe, along with earthquakes, tsunami, which are the tidal waves produced by earthquakes. They're not really tidal in origin at all, but shock waves from earthquakes in the ocean. Landslides and mud flows and avalanches, things like that. And less dramatic but equally important, things like soil erosion, which is essentially a natural process. Then if we consider atmospheric processes that are hazardous, the dramatic things would be things like tornadoes, hurricanes, but also some of the more everyday kinds of storms, blizzards, if you live in Minnesota. We even have our hazards in the Midwest. Hail, high wind, lightning, any others here?
Drought.
That's a good one. One that's on the border of both geological and atmospheric would be floods, typically caused by large rains or snow melt. Any other hazardous things you can think of?
Hot and cold.
Hot and cold. Heat waves, maybe. And cold snaps. Forest fires. And really, to this list, we might add a third category. We don't think about those quite as often, but biological hazards. Things like insects, diseases, weeds, noxious weeds, things like that. Kind of a general list. The point is that there are a lot of things in the environment that pose potential hazards for human activity and affect human activity in some very real ways. Not often, but when they happen, they can have some very disastrous effects. And again, one thing to note is that there really is no place in the world that doesn't have some kind of environmental hazard to it. We think of the West Coast as being perhaps more hazardous because we hear so much about volcanoes and earthquakes out here. But many, particularly of the atmospheric problems, the tornadoes, the hail, the storms, happen all over the Midwest. And in some cases, more people die in the Midwest from storm-related injuries and events than die on the West Coast from earthquakes and volcanoes. Now, one thing to notice about these processes is that they are part of the natural processes within the environment. These aren't freaks of nature. They are just part of the ongoing everyday processes within the Earth and the atmosphere. They are related to the continual shifting of the continental and crustal plates as they shift around on the Earth's surface, and the atmospheric phenomena are related to the circulation of the atmosphere. All of these processes operate over a range of intensities. And most of the time we don't notice them happening, even though they still go on. Occasionally, we get these very high magnitude events that we call disasters. And sometimes those high magnitude events will affect human activity. Now, when we talk about these events, these natural processes, we're concerned about two things primarily. How big is it in terms of the intensity of the event or the magnitude of the event? And how often does it happen? That's how we would define the threat, if you will, of these events. How big is it? How often does it happen? Now, the frequency or the recurrence of the event is basically determined as a probability. And we will talk about probabilities of these events in terms of how often they happen. Now, in floods, you may be familiar with the term a 50-year flood or a 100-year flood as a way to describe the probability of these things occurring. A 100-year flood is a flood that is so big that you usually only get one that size every 100 years. That's the way the probability is described. It's such a big flood, it only happens once every 100 years. That doesn't mean that you have 100 years between each flood. That's just a description of the probability. You may get 200-year floods in the same year. It's quite possible. But it's a low probability of that happening. Now, in addition to this magnitude and frequency, we also talk about how long the process lasts. Is it a short storm or a short earthquake or a long volcanic eruption? How big an area does it affect? How fast does it happen? How often does it happen? Those are some of the characteristics that we're concerned about. Now, So far we've just talked about the process, but if you really want to consider the risk of a natural hazard, you have to consider not only the likelihood that this process will happen, but you also have to think about how many people would be affected. And here's where we come to the relationship between the environment and human activity. Because we're concerned not just with when will these big events happen, but who's going to be affected by them. And that's where geographers get involved in this study of natural hazards. Here we're concerned about the vulnerability of the population to the natural process. And that's when it becomes a hazard, is when people get affected. It's sort of like the old thing of a tree falling in the forest. If nobody was there, would there be a sound? If an earthquake or a volcano erupts where there's nobody to be affected, it's not going to matter too much. But if an earthquake happens in San Francisco, we've got millions of people to be affected, then it becomes an important issue. So it's the population at risk that really makes it hazardous. The largest earthquake in the United States was not in California. It was in Missouri. But it happened in 1811, 1812, and hardly anybody lived in Missouri back then. So it didn't get much attention. So our next question has to be, what risk is there to the population? And there's a lot of things that affect the vulnerability of the population, not just how many people there are, but what kinds of conditions they live in. What do they have safe shelter? What are their buildings like? Do they have some kind of warning system that could alert them to the possibility of this hazard? All of those things would help decrease the vulnerability of the population. When we talk about the risk to people in the environment, we're concerned about the potential death and injury of these people. We're concerned about the loss of crops, particularly from weather-related things, and damage to property and buildings. Now, people have a wide range of possible responses to these hazards, to the risk of these hazards. One is denial. That's not going to happen to me. We don't have to worry about that. You ever watch interviews on the news after a disaster and you listen to what people say? I can't believe it happened to me. I never expected it. That's the classic sort of response to a natural disaster. We have a short corporate memory, I guess, to these kinds of events. And the longer it's been since the last tornado, or the longer it's been since the last earthquake, the fuzzier our memory gets of exactly what the risks are. Another response would be just to accept the loss, to absorb it. If your house is wiped out by a tornado, you rebuild and you go on. Or to share the loss in the form of insurance, or through government assistance. Another response would be to try and decrease the loss, try and actively reduce the loss that could happen. One way would be to try and control the hazard itself. So we hear a lot about flood control projects on rivers. Or one example of this would be in Iceland. A number of years ago, a town was threatened by a lava flow. And the lava was moving closer and closer and closer to the city. And rather than give up, the people there started pumping water onto the lava, started cooling it down. They got out the fire hoses and some fire ships. And over several weeks, just continued to pump more and more water on the lava and cooled it off. And that built up a wall that diverted the rest of the lava away from the town. So they were able to change the process enough to avert complete disaster. The other way to try and reduce the loss is to try and undertake some sort of preventative action to prevent the loss from affecting you quite as badly. In California, that might take the form of building codes and standards for earthquake proofness, earthquake proofing the buildings. Now, you can go only so far with that sort of building code approach, but it made a big difference in San Francisco with the most recent earthquake. If you think about the buildings and the places that were damaged by the earthquake most severely, it was the places, the buildings, the roads that didn't meet the codes, didn't meet the present building codes. Another way that we try and reduce the loss from these hazards is to set up detection and warning systems so that we invest millions of dollars in very sophisticated weather stations so that we can track hurricanes and we can track potential thunderstorms that could cause tornadoes. We invest a lot of money in trying to predict when earthquakes are going to happen, even though we're not too successful at that yet. We're a little more successful at predicting volcanoes. So we are both trying to control the process when that's possible. And again, it's not always possible to control these natural processes, but we're also doing things to try and reduce our vulnerability to the loss. Those are positive actions. And a final response that people might have would be just to give up, to change, to move back to the Midwest, to change the kinds of crops you grow if those crops are too vulnerable to the possibility of drought. Now, one thing that we need to also keep in mind is that things that we do can increase our vulnerability to hazards. We can increase the hazardousness of the environment. One thing is that people often put themselves at risk either knowingly or unknowingly. One thing about hazardous places is that they are often attractive places to live. You think about the desirability of living beside a river, for example, or the desirability of having a home on the beach, or living in the mountains. A lot of the most attractive places to live, the places with the highest amenities, are places that are very hazardous. And so people will put themselves at risk and go ahead and build their home on the floodplain or build their beach house and figure that it's not going to happen to them. And if it does happen to them, then they'll have insurance or the government to turn to. Another way that we affect the hazardous processes in the environment is by actually altering natural processes. And this is picking up more on what many of our other sessions have dealt with this summer, is that people alter the natural processes of the environment. And in many ways, that can increase the hazardousness of the environment. One example would be in removing vegetation, cutting forests or removing vegetation for agriculture. By removing natural vegetation, you increase the runoff of rainwater from the landscape, which increases the likelihood of flooding, increases the amount of sediment that gets into the rivers. Another example would be flood control projects. That's kind of an odd way to think about it, but in many cases when people start tinkering with rivers to try and control them, they end up increasing the flood hazard more than when they started. One example would be channelization of rivers. One approach to flood control is to straighten a river out. And when you straighten out a river, it becomes more efficient. The water flows through it faster, so that it reduces the flood hazard in the area where the channel has been straightened, because the river is more efficient at draining away the excess water from the landscape. But as soon as you straighten out the river in one place, all the water just goes downstream and someone else has to deal with it. So flood control projects in one place might increase the hazard downstream And there, one place where we've experienced that is in on the border of Indiana and Illinois, in the Kankakee River. In Indiana, they've straightened out the river and they've tried to drain the land there for agriculture and have flood control using this river. But all the water ends up in Illinois, and the people in Illinois aren't ever too happy about it when that happens. And in a long-term perspective, if we look at problems like the greenhouse effect, if people increase the temperature of the atmosphere through the addition of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane, one of the effects of this global warming would be an increase in the probability of droughts and the length of droughts when they happen. So that a lot of the things that we've listed here can be exacerbated in terms of their hazard potential by the things people do to the environment. Now, one last point I'd like you to think about a little bit is consider also the relationship between natural hazards and development in less developed countries. If we talk about vulnerability to hazards, consider the vulnerability of people in the United States versus the vulnerability of people in a country like Bangladesh or India, one of the poorer countries of the world. Generally speaking, less developed countries are more vulnerable to natural hazards than the industrialized countries are. Generally speaking, they have, as because of their problems of high population growth, they have oftentimes a lot of people concentrated in small areas, particularly a lot of people concentrated in urban areas. Urbanization has become a major process within less developed countries, so that you have a lot of people living in a fairly small area. Again, that alone increases the risk. Many of the people that live in cities live under conditions of extreme poverty in shanty towns and slum-like developments. And just think about what the buildings are like in those shanty towns in cities like Bombay or Calcutta. They're just shacks built out of tar paper or cardboard boxes or whatever people can find available. And those buildings, those shanties, offer virtually no protection from these natural hazards. They don't have available the kind of building technology, building codes, building materials that are available here in the United States. Many of these countries don't have detection or warning systems to alert their people to the possibility of a hazard, to track storms, to predict when the storms are going to land. They have no way to get the warning out to people, even if they could predict them. And the relief services in those countries are generally inadequate. So that once the disaster happens, the total loss of life is worse because there's no relief services available to come in afterwards to help people that are affected. So all in all, the less developed countries are much more highly vulnerable to the damages, the ravages of these natural hazards than our more developed countries. Think about some recent examples. Earthquakes. Compare in your mind, if you can think back to the news of the day, compare the Armenian earthquake in Soviet Union a couple years ago with the recent San Francisco earthquake. Now both of those earthquakes were about the same intensity. But in San Francisco, where the building codes are fairly stringent, where the disaster relief services are good, where the building materials are good, The loss of life was fairly minimal. I think 62 people died in the San Francisco earthquake. The property damage was immense, $6 billion, but that's because these industrialized countries have a lot of capital invested in their buildings and their factories and their stores and their infrastructure, but very little loss of life. And the city was basically functioning again within a week. The World Series went on and everything was fine. Armenia was very heavily devastated by the same size of earthquake. They had old concrete masonry buildings, buildings that could not stand the shaking of an earthquake, no relief services. Many parts of Armenia are still devastated several years later. They just haven't rebuilt. They haven't had the capital to rebuild afterwards. Both earthquakes, about the same size, but much more devastating in a poorer country than in the United States. Same could be said of comparing something like a tropical cyclone, a hurricane in the south coast, the Atlantic coast of North America versus a hurricane in Bangladesh. A hurricane in the United States might cause half a dozen deaths. A hurricane in Bangladesh could cause tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of deaths because of so many people concentrated into sites that are unsuitable, unsafe for the effects of those damages. In some ways, we might consider how the hazardousness of a country affects its prospects for development. In some ways, a hazardous country, a country that has a number of natural hazards, and some countries are more vulnerable, have more of a mix of natural hazards than others, that would tend to discourage investment in development projects. It would, when the hazards happen, they are a drain on the economy of the country. Trying to recover from the hazards represents a serious drain on the economic system of the country. And particularly when these countries try to copy Western patterns of development, in terms of urbanization and industrialization, those Western patterns of development are more vulnerable within those countries because they don't have the same technology available. So, I guess, as we look back on the things I've tried to just toss out for you to think about here, the risk of any natural hazard depends not just on how big the potential hazard is, but also how many people are at risk and what the vulnerability of those people are. And vulnerability is always higher in less developed, poorer countries. One thing I'd like you to think about, if we consider this in light of our theme for the summer, the problem we experience with natural hazards may represent yet more evidence that we are not living in harmony with our environment. The fact that people are not paying attention to the way the natural processes work. I'm not that we will ever eliminate the threat, the risk of natural hazards, but if we understood them more and paid attention to the risk and lived accordingly, we might be able to reduce the danger of those natural hazards. And the way that we treat the environment does in some cases increase our risk to these natural hazards. That's basically what I hope to kind of share with you this afternoon. I'd like to open it up a little bit if you've got questions or other comments about these things. personal experiences that come to mind, any of these hazards?
A lot of these things are evident. I know that at the time of the volcanic eruption of Mount St. Helens, everybody was warned. Still, all those people just had to go there, and they were there when the event happened. So a lot of those deaths were needless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like Harry Truman up there, he wasn't going to leave his little bit of heaven.
So yeah.
He just knows where he is. He just dissolved with nature.
He became part of it, I guess. That was a case where clearly there were adequate warnings and predictions.
All of the scientific things were, evidence was there, but there always those, as you say, that's not going to happen while I'm there.
Mm-hmm. Of course, with Mount St. Helens, one of the things that kind of caught people by surprise was the fact that it erupted sideways.
Right, they weren't anticipating.
That wasn't expected, so the damage extended farther to the north than what they thought it would, but no, they knew it was going to happen.
You know, knowing that was happening, I don't think I would want to be that close to
it. Does seem to me that when we think about all of these things that could happen, it gives us a different perspective on nature. That most of us tend to be afraid of things like walking down a dark street at night by ourselves. You know, we're afraid of things that have to do with people. I've spent a lot of time worrying about natural hazards, except that tree over our garage. You worry about that sometimes. But mostly I think about nature being pretty benevolent.
I think we cause a lot when you realize, talking about in Illinois, Indiana, I'm from Illinois also, and the development in the Chicago urban area, suburban area, where the floodplains are being built on, bring in dirt, put a house there. Doesn't matter, the water goes someplace else.
Yeah.
And in many ways, how we affect the water ends up, you know, creating droughts and so forth in that way, because we're forcing the water out of its natural.
Yeah, forcing it downstream faster and altering the local hydrologic cycle.
The cutting of the trees.
Deforestation.
Remember, we've been in the Seattle area for a long time, and you go over the peninsula and see all this clear cut. Used to be, you know, nothing but a forest of trees on the side of the mountain, and now there's nothing there. That has to have an effect.
Now, some ways we don't even understand yet. Mm-hmm. Another place that's kind of a classic example of people kind of ignoring the hazard is on the barrier islands of the Atlantic coast. Mm-hmm. The barrier islands are sand islands offshore, low sandy islands, and they're just covered with vacation homes. People just, in some cases, year-round homes.
Yeah.
And
because
it's so expensive, the land is so expensive, those are homes that, you know, $100 to $200 to $500 to $1 million range in terms of their value. And yet, when you think about the vulnerability of those places to a hurricane, those are dynamic environments. The barrier islands are just sand. I think the Bible says something about building houses on sand even. But, you know, hurricane comes along, wipes out a few houses, and they're back the next year building there and hoping to get some insurance to cover it.
I think our present hazards are of a different character. Insofar as you can get away from most of these by use of your wits. You don't live where there are earthquakes. If there haven't been any earthquakes in a certain area, then you're pretty sure you're afraid. As long as you know, then you're pretty sure. What else? You won't live near the ocean where you get the hurricanes, and you don't have to live whether it's rivers or floods. Maybe tornadoes are a little more difficult to calculate. little less predictable. Well, most of those things are predictable. You can move away from them, mm-hmm. but I don't see how you're going to move away from the effects of the ozone. Certainly, you're not going to move down to Australia or Tasmania, or where the increase in cancer is already very noticeable. You won't do that, but generally speaking, I don't know how you're going to get away from those ultraviolet rays. You can't move away, you can only protect yourself. And I don't, global warming, so we don't know how to predict what that's going to do to our environment. So I don't know, I think that throws all these natural hazards in the kind of, in terms of predicting where they're going to occur. We don't know where the tornadoes and where the...
As the warming starts to affect the atmospheric circulation, it's going to throw off the patterns.
So I think it's pretty hard. These things we can... If you live, you know, in San Francisco or on the West Coast, you know you're going to get an earthquake every now and then, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
So you've decided.
You've decided.
I don't think we have much control over the ozone.
No.
But I do think that there's an important parallel to the way we respond. That it may be that part of our response to the ozone problem and to the greenhouse effect is conditioned by our long-term response to these things. You know, some people live in Southern California. My whole immediate family lives in Southern California, and they know that there are earthquakes, you know, so they don't really think about it. I don't think about tornadoes. We're kind of in this mindset that, oh yeah, bad things happen, but calculate the risk and don't worry about it. If it happens, you deal with it. And it's hard for us to switch into the more urgent mindset that perhaps these more novel hazards require.
We always say it won't happen in our time, of course.
Yeah.
Now, it does suggest that some of our nature mystics haven't taken the full range of nature into account.
No.
That's the kind of thrust I get from your presentation.
No,
it isn't this lovely, beautiful nature completely.
No. Or at least you need to pay attention to its dangerous side.
Yeah. I think too many times we think that we're smart enough to control it. You know, we can control nature and we can do this, but we're not really.
In one of Mark Edwards' sessions this week, he was talking about Luther's view of nature and how to Luther, nature was something very frightening and horrific. Because the plague and, you know, and thunderstorm, of course, there's the legendary case of the thunderstorm. He wasn't at all romantic about it. But this is terrifying. This is really scary business.
Well, it's a nice afternoon. Let's go soak up some sunshine before the picnic. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.